There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. I recently stumbled upon a fascinating blog post written last year by Graham Betcher, director of the Birmingham Museum of Art in Birmingham, Alabama. In the piece, Graham writes candidly about the museum's troubling Jim Crow-era policies in the first dozen years of its existence. The headline read, "Director Reckons with Art Museum's Ugly Past." We recently sat down with Graham to see what that reckoning was all about. Now, what you're about to hear is a conversation between two white guys about some serious and sensitive topics. We understand that. In coming episodes and seasons, we plan to have many more discussions about issues of race and inclusion in museums. This is just one tile in that mosaic. So I wanted to begin with a discussion of the piece that you wrote last year. I just came across it, and this was a blog post you wrote kind of dealing with some of the, you know, more troubling issues that the museum has in its past. And can you talk a little bit about the decision to talk about those things publicly? Was that sparked by something that made you want to respond in a way to write this piece? Or was it something that since you've taken over as director, you've been wanting to be more upfront with some of the touchy things about the museum's past?
It's something I had actually spoken about on many occasions and had written about once before, but in a less public forum. I wrote a piece that talked about the history of the museum with respect to race and Jim Crow in our museum magazine, which is called Medium, but that only reaches our members. But one of the things that I decided when I became director a year and a half ago to do is to really push for creating a sense of ownership and belonging among all the people in Birmingham. We're a department of the city of Birmingham. We've been a department of the city of Birmingham since 1951. But for the first couple of decades of our existence, I really feel like we failed to serve our entire community and city. And so I think part of changing that is owning one's mistakes and owning that failure to serve. And that means being open and candid about it, which it's never really been a secret, but it's not really something that we have discussed openly. And I felt like in order to really look toward the future and build a sense of trust and belonging, that we had to really be candid about that chapter in the museum's history.
For those who don't know and haven't read the piece, as you mentioned, the museum opened in 1951, and it is a city-owned museum. And just describe what the standing policies were. Now, this is in the middle of the Jim Crow South. Jim Crow laws are in full effect in 1951. Talk about what the policies were when the museum opened.
So, as you mentioned, we were founded in the midst of the Jim Crow era, 1951, immediately founded as a department of the city of Birmingham, which I think, as you know, is where Jim Crow laws were probably most severely enforced, largely because of an individual named Bull Connor, who was our superintendent of public safety. At that time, the city did not have, it had a mayor, but it did not have a structure, a city council structure. It instead had public supervisors or superintendents. And Bull Connor was a very staunch enforcer of Jim Crow. Actually, his proper title was Commissioner of Public Safety, to get it exactly right. But I think it's safe to say for those people who have seen the photographs of Birmingham and the way that Bull Connor enforced the law, it created anything but a sense of public safety, quite the contrary. Those Jim Crow laws extended to all public institutions and venues, including the Birmingham Museum of Art. Originally, the museum was housed in City Hall, and then later in 1959, we opened the building that we are in now, which is across the park from City Hall. Because of the idea that all the city had to offer its citizens was separate but equal, and being that we were the only art museum, they could not fully deny access to Black citizens from the museum. So instead, what they offered was admission solely on one day a week, and that was Tuesdays, the quote-unquote colored-only visiting day. I mean, my personal feeling is that if you're only allowed into a building one day a week, that pretty much sends the message that you're not really welcome there at all. That being the case, there were some individuals, most notably the well-known American artist David Driskell, who at that time was a young assistant professor of art at Talladega College. And he set out from Talladega with some of his art students with the intention of showing his students a great original collection of art in nearby Birmingham. As the story was told by Dr. Driskell himself, he arrived at the museum. A nervous guard kind of gave him a once-over and immediately summoned the director, Richard Howard. Richard Howard was a, nowadays we would say liberal, back then we would say progressive. He was a kind of a FDR New Dealer who had been a monuments man in the Second World War and had taken the helm of a number of museums in their fledgling years, including ours. And so the guard summoned Richard Howard, who, according to David Driskell, came and spoke with him and offered to give Dr. Driskell and his students a personal tour if they'd come back on Tuesday, the appointed day. Alas, they never came back. Dr. Driskell came back and, in fact, shared this story from the stage of our auditorium in 2009 when he was being honored by our museum. And so he the irony of being welcomed, embraced, and honored by an institution that had once refused him entry at the door was not lost on him or anyone else in the audience for that matter.
You know, you've been in your position there as director for not very long, a year and a half now. And
right.
When you decided to start talking about these things, did you see any response locally, meaning, you know, were people there saying, finally, we need to kind of readdress some of these issues because we can't fully move on without kind of looking to the past and seeing, you know, what mistakes were made? Were people saying, hey, you know, that's the past, let's leave it in the past, don't, you know, you're sullying the museum's reputation? Did you see kind of both sides of that argument come to play when you started talking about some of these issues?
I definitely saw both sides. There are undeniably individuals in our community who feel that we should not talk about the past and that Birmingham spends too much time talking about the civil rights era. Those individuals, not exclusively, though oftentimes tend to be individuals who were not hurt by those policies of Jim Crow. And so it's easy for them to say, oh, let's just move on, when they don't bear any of the scars from that era, and neither do their children or grandchildren. So it's the response, I would say the majority of it has been positive, but I was cautioned when the blog was reposted on AL.com, which is the kind of online platform for the Alabama media group, including the Birmingham News. I've always been cautioned, don't read the comments. Because when individuals can comment without repercussion anonymously, there's no filter. And, you know, fortunately, the comments didn't get too personal, though I have a thick skin. But a number of the comments felt like, oh, you know, here we go again, drudging up the past. Why can't we just move on? Well, a recent incident here in our community underscored the fact why we can't just move on without talking about these things. There was a video that went viral, recorded by a group of students at Spain Park High School, which is not in Birmingham proper, but in a township immediately adjacent to Birmingham, in which a group of all white students were celebrating the Holocaust and saying just egregious, shocking, racist and anti-Semitic remarks.
These problems are not of the past. We're dealing with these every day. I wonder, just to step back to what we were talking about before. So the museum's policy as an official policy came to an end in 1963.
That's right.
The city leadership you were mentioning before, the quote-unquote commissioner for public safety, Bull Connor,
right,
was ousted, and everything kind of underwent a change. Now, that was, like 12 years into the museum's existence.
Exactly.
But Birmingham as a city, of course, in 1963 was still quite embroiled in the Jim Crow era. I mean, this was more about citywide buildings and institutions. It was not like everything in the whole city was wiped off the map. So when that changed and it became less of an actual official policy, did the museum make an abrupt about face, or, was it something that had to really take, the next 5, 10, 15 years to work itself into the operating daily procedures of the museum?
I wish I could say that there was an abrupt change and that the museum quickly opened its doors wide open to visitors from, every race, creed, and all parts of the community. But in point of fact, based on the evidence that I've been able to find, that's not the case. What archival photos that I've seen from after the Jim Crow laws were repealed in 1963, it's a long time before you start to see any non-white faces appear in casual, press photos of museum gatherings. And one of the chief ways that we measure kind of the direction of the museum is in the character of our collection. And it wasn't until 1971, 20 years after the museum was founded, that we accessioned the first work of art by an African-American artist. That also happens to be the same year that Richard Arrington became our city's first African-American city councilman. And then he went on to become our first African-American mayor. And so that was a year of great change, 1971. Interestingly, though, the work that we accessioned, it was by Henry Ossawa Tanner, a legendary African-American artist who spent most of his life working in France because of the adversity that he faced as an artist of color here in the United States. But the following year, 1972, we purchased for the first time a work by a living African-American artist, and that was a work by none other than Dr. David Driskell.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Accession Numbers. In libraries, art galleries, museums, and archives, an accession number is a unique identifier assigned to each acquisition. Basically, it's like a social security number for a piece of art. This might sound a little boring, but they sure do come in handy when you're dealing with a bunch of Monet river paintings that kind of depict the very same scene on the very same river and are therefore mostly indistinguishable. Think about that the next time you're at MoMA, perhaps looking at 472.1941, or, as you might like to call it, the Starry Night. To err is human, but we in museum world can always count on accession numbers.
Talk about the museum from as an institution. So we had this moment in the early 1970s where things really started to get more officially set in stone in terms of becoming a more welcoming and a more diverse city and institution. But what about from the board level to the staff level, just today even, in 2019? How do you guys go about making sure that the museum's leadership and staff are as diverse as the city that it's in?
I mean, that is a great, continues to be a great challenge for us. And I think with respect to our Board of Trustees, we've made great strides. And in fact, several years ago, the museum had its first black board chair, Ralph Cook, who is a judge and a prominent attorney here in Birmingham. And he and his wife have a longstanding relationship with our museum. I think it's a constant work in progress. While I look at the makeup of our board, especially relative to other museums nationwide, and I think, well, we've got a board that in many ways is diverse, both in terms of race, age, gender, and that's all very important. When I look at our staff, frankly, I think that we've got a ways to go. And so more recently, we've been really looking at how can we build a pipeline, because it's not for lack of trying. We work really diligently to try to identify diverse candidates when we have an open position. And we have recently adopted some new strategies, such as sending job announcements broadly to all city department heads and ask for their assistance in recruiting talent. And also even to the city council. I mean, that's, you know, I'm constantly trying new things to try to get the word out about job postings with the desire to ensure that we have a diverse pool of applicants from which to interview and hire. But I know one thing we really have to devote more time and resources to is to looking at students at a very kind of a critical stage in their development when they're making decisions about what they want to study and what direction they want to take for a career path, and making the case for the arts being a viable path. There's so much attention put on STEM, and that, you know, in order to have a pathway to success, you need to be in science, math, you know, technology. I'm a bigger advocate of STEAM. I think that the arts are important and that they do offer a wide variety of excellent career paths. But I think especially looking at individuals who maybe come from historically disenfranchised communities, and if you're a first-generation student, first person in your family to go to college, there's a huge burden of responsibility that goes along with that, and maybe a lot of pressure to pick a career path that is, you know, more typically viewed as a good path. And
this
I'd
is like
to
the
make
doctor,
case.
Doctor, lawyer path. You
yeah,
know.
Well, I have to
engineer,
say, you know,
engineer,
when I announced
yeah.
to my parents that I was headed into art history, I think they were worried too, because, you know, I'm not the first person in my family to attend college, but I am the first person to graduate in my family. And I went to Yale as an undergrad. I had huge student loans, not as large as they are today for most students, but large enough. And I think they thought, oh my gosh, what are you doing here? We expected you to be a physician or a lawyer, and you're becoming what? An art historian. And then when I announced that I wasn't planning to be a professor of art history, but rather a curator, well, it's sort of like a curator. Well, what's that? What does a curator
right.
do? So I feel a little bit of this myself and kind of know what some students with an interest in the arts must be up against at home. In terms of breaking away from family expectations and forging their own path. I think it's incredibly difficult, but I want the museum to be a place where we cultivate and groom talent and show individuals that there's a pathway into the arts. And I think that's really the only the way that we're going to, you know, create greater diversity in the museum field, which is one of the historically and presently one of the least diverse fields around, sadly.
So 2 years from now, two-ish years from now, you're going to be hitting the 50th anniversary of that first acquisition of an African-American piece of art. How does the collection now look? You know, if 50 years ago almost you acquired the first work by an African-American, and now it's 2019, how diverse is that permanent collection now compared to what it was, of course, then, which was obviously not at all?
That's one of the things I think we're really proud of, is that we forged ahead and, you know, beginning in the 1970s, but really gathering a lot of steam in the 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s, and made diversity and inclusion a cornerstone of our collecting practice, particularly with contemporary artists. And we, you know, we recently had an exhibition called Third Space, Shifting Conversations About Contemporary Art, which was up for 2 years. It opened in January of 2017 and closed in January of 2019. And we were really proud of the fact that of the 100 works on view, the majority of which were from our permanent collection, the vast majority, with maybe only one or two exceptions, were by artists of color, predominantly African-American, but also Latinx artists as well, and some Asian artists. And it was really great to see the progress, because in that same exhibition, the David Driskell painting acquired in 1972 was hanging alongside things that had been acquired in the subsequent decades. And it was really exciting to see how far the collection had come. And it was also exciting that people outside of Birmingham, I mean, what our primary audience is right here in Birmingham. So what we do is for the people of our community, state, and region. But it was great that this particular exhibition caught national attention, thanks in no small part to Holland Cotter naming it to the best art of 2017 in the year-end issue of the New York Times.
Finally, do you have discussions with your colleagues who run other museums, other museum directors, especially museum directors that may have similar pasts at their institutions? Of course, you know, you were not alone being at the Birmingham Museum of
Right.
Art. There are a lot of museums in the American South that had similar issues. Do you feel like you're out there kind of talking about this on your own? Do you see a broader conversation happening with leaders of other museums?
Both in the region and nationally. Last month, I attended the Association of Art Museum Directors meeting in Richmond, Virginia, and diversity and inclusion in all its forms were major topics of that gathering. And much attention has been paid on a national level, both from the Association of Art Museum Directors and the Association of Art Museum Curators, whose board I served on for 7 years before becoming director. About this precise issue and the need to create paid internships that can provide individuals who are thinking about a career path in the museum field, art museum field, with the opportunity to gain a foothold in that field, and specifically internships that are geared toward bringing diversity to the institution. But then beyond that, we need to look at, well, when you've got an intern who has, you know, finished their time with you at the institution, what happens then? How do you create for them a permanent position or inroads into permanent employment in art museums? So it's probably the single greatest topic of conversation in the art museum field right now on a national level, but also for us, we have the Southeastern Art Museum directors and the directors of all the art museums, large and small, in the Southeast. We get together once a year. It's far less formal. I think when it was started years ago by a group of directors, they said our only rule is that there are no rules, which makes for, I mean, as much as I love the Association of Art Museum Directors, the Southeastern Art Museum Directors, who are our closest, you know, friends and neighbors in the region, because of this kind of open forum, we have very, very candid discussions about all of the issues that we face in the region. And many of those conversations have focused on precisely this topic, not only diversifying the workforce at art museums, diversifying our audiences, and diversifying our collections.
One of the most important chapters in the history of indigenous art happened right here in our backyard. In 1946, Philbrook established a juried competition known as the Indian Annual. A dozen years into the competition, Oscar Howe, a previous grand prize winner, had a work rejected because, according to the committee, it didn't adhere to the acceptable styles of native art. So Oscar Howe wrote a letter and changed the course of art history.
Whoever said that my paintings are not in the traditional Indian style has poor knowledge of Indian art indeed. There is much more to Indian art than pretty, stylized pictures. There was also power and strength and individualism, emotional and intellectual insight in the old Indian paintings. Every bit in my paintings is a true studied fact of Indian paintings. Are we to be held back forever with one phase of Indian painting, with no right for individualism dictated to, as the Indian has always been, put on reservations and treated like a child, and only the white man knows what is best for him? Now, even in art, you little child, do what we think is best for you, nothing different. Well, I am not going to stand for it. Indian art can compete with any art in the world, but not as a suppressed art.
In response, Philbrook added a new category in 1959. They called it non-traditional painting. Oscar Howe both entered and won. Perhaps the most lasting legacy of this legendary letter boils down to two words: visual sovereignty. To put it more simply, Native people get to define what Native art actually is. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.